get started. I would like to call this meeting the March 1st meeting of the Health, Human Services, and Housing Committee to order. Here we got the recording going?
Yes, sir.
Excellent. All right. I will begin by entertaining a motion to approve the minutes from the February 1st meeting.
Make that motion.
Motion by Nolan, second by Corcoran. Any discussion on the minutes? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Because we have a lighter than usual agenda today, I asked members of the county executive's team to share with us some updates on the programs around housing and mental health specifically. So if it's all right with everyone, I'd like to start with Commissioner McDonald, and we can learn about where we are at specifically. We're curious about the Crisis Stabilization Center and Rust Bite Houses.
Thank you for the opportunity to be able to give this update, Chair Utah. We're very excited. In terms of the Crisis Support Service Stabilization Center, the architectural plans have been finalized earlier this year, so we have a schematic of what it's expected to look like, which is very exciting to be able to visualize. All of us are on board in terms of there are three providers that will be working together in order to operate. The Stabilization Center, People USA, Ellenville Regional Hospital, and Gateway Industries. And all of the providers are very excited by the plans and were able to be have input in terms of how the space should look in order for it to be both licensable and engaging and ready to receive folks in order to be able to provide them a service. There's just a way in which they want the aesthetics to look and for the building to feel, and they were really excited by the architectural plan. So those were finalized earlier. We're in the middle of drafting our contract with People USA, who is the lead provider. They'll be facilitating the entire process, and the license will be under their name. The hope is that we'll be able to have the contract finalized by May, June, though we're not expecting for the service to begin until maybe October, late fall. They do want to be able to start to bring on a program director so that they would have someone that is both operational in terms of the programming but also a part of the implementation and development. And we'll really start with the buy-in at the beginning. So if we can start to get them some startup funds, they can do some of that in terms of recruitment. So we're in the midst of contract drafting for them. And then I believe that we are putting out bids for the actual construction work for the renovation of the first floor. And that's where we are with that. Any questions before I move on to that?
Do you have a timeline for like what the next phase and kind of just in the grand scope of the program, how far we are from opening it?
Absolutely. So the goal that we're setting is to be able to have it open in the fall of 2023. So October is the date that we've been using as our ultimate goal date. But there are many phases in between then, but we're working them concurrently. So between the drafting of the contract, we've already started conversations with the Office of Mental Health to start the licensing part of this, and then the construction. So we're doing all of those concurrently, not necessarily waiting for one to be able to be accomplished before we start another. That's the only way that we'll be able to hit that goal of October.
And are there any requests that might come before the legislature between now and then that we can expect?
The approval of the contract.
Okay. And that's for the construction? Or for the actual contract with People?
The actual contract with People to allow for the operational dollars to flow to them.
And the construction. You'll get a resolution for the construction as well.
Great. Do you know about what time, like when, what the timing is for that?
So we're waiting to...
I didn't hear Beth.
Yeah, we don't have the timing for the actual construction resolution.
Yeah, we put out bids right at the beginning.
Yeah. Actually, I don't... So we're still waiting for the specs. We have a conceptual design, but then we need the specifications, and then that will come with a cost estimate, and then after that, we would put out the bid for contractors. So I think we're still a couple months out
in
that process.
Any other questions before I keep dominating with more questions, which I don't want to do.
Keep going.
All right. So one thing that I want to be considerate of as we go through this year, especially if we're, you know, about 8 months away from opening the doors, is, you know, as questions come up about contracts and about, you know, speccing things out, that often is where, you know, all of us, you know, and our colleagues like to weigh in and make sure that everything is, you know, everything is being considered, everything is being done smoothly. I don't want to have us feel like we're in a position where we're holding up the project. Mm-hmm. So anything, any consideration that can be made to like any questions that might come up that we can start discussing before a resolution appears, or even if resolutions can you know, come not the month they have to pass, but maybe the month before they have to pass,
mm-hmm.
Where we don't want to be in a position where we have to advance, you know, a resolution that we just saw a week ago because that's the only way we're going to hit the October deadline.
Got it. Yeah, I think that's fair, especially when we're talking about a project like this that's pretty major. So once we start to get more specifics on the construction, I think we can we'll share it as early as possible.
Any other questions before we move on to another topic? All right, is there anything that was regarding the Crisis Support Center, the respite houses?
Yes.
Yep, thank you.
So we're in the midst of drafting a SOQ of saving qualifications, and we're hoping to publicize that in early March. So since it's the first, let's say mid-March. And that would be looking for a provider for the crisis respite service. We have an eye on a potential site for the crisis residence. The site is in Ellenville. It is it's near downtown, very centrally located, close to places to be able to buy groceries and in the midst of town, very close to the transit, to the bus line, very serene and the mountains around you, quiet, really a place where someone would be able to go and take a respite from whatever crisis it is that, you know, has them wanting to be able to step away from life for 7 to 28 days. So we haven't put in any official intention for that potential site, but we are working towards that. But while we're doing that, again, concurrently drafting the SOQ to say if we have a site, then we need a provider. So we're hoping that we'll have some responses to the SOQ. The spot will be the service will be licensable so that the provider would be able to have the resources in terms of the county owns the property. However, in them agreeing to be able to provide the service, they would bill. And those resources would go back to their agency to be able to reinvest into other services and to the crisis budget.
Any questions? So we would, in this case, we would be, as the county, we would be owning the building.
The building.
Owning or renting?
Owning. We would purchase the building.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is the building that you're looking at, is that on the market currently?
Yes, I believe it is, yes.
Yeah, and just so for context, I have been working with Legislator Walter on this as the prior chair, and because she has originated the resolution, but I'm happy to loop you in as well so that you're involved in everything.
Well, I definitely trust Eve's expertise. I will not be able to hold a candle to her you know, many degrees in the topic, but I would love to be able to keep the whole committee in the loop if we can.
Definitely.
Yeah, thank you. Legislator Erner?
Just to clarify, this is going to be the one respite house for Ulster County?
It's the one. I know that there's two in the resolution, but this will be the first one.
First, yeah.
Thank you.
Would it be fair to say that, I know this is kind of flipping the narrative on its head, but that we'll consider Northern Ulster for the perhaps the second one?
Perhaps Western Ulster.
We were wanted to
be Pine Hill.
I do have a lot of respect for folks needing to step out of the city of Kingston and take in the mountains to recuperate. So I do that myself.
I appreciate you throw us a bone every once in a while. Yeah, it's kind of refreshing that there's actually, you know, going to be something down our way. So, yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions or discussion on that topic? All right. Thank you so much. Is there anything else, Commissioner? Okay, thank you so much. And then I would like to ask, I guess, Deputy Executive Contreras for an update on some of the housing initiatives, and I'd ask that you touch on the quality in Elizabeth Manor, and I feel like I'm forgetting one.
The affordable rental upgrade campaign.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, the affordable rental upgrade campaign. If you have an update on Golden Hill, that would be, I think Legislator Erner just mentioned that. It would be nice if there's a quick update on that.
Sure.
But if that's a larger discussion, we can handle it a different way.
Okay. So starting with Elizabeth Manor, we have the initial demolition plan. We've received them. The ARPA team has been working with the architect and DPW to get the project cost certified, schedule the demo, and get all the steps checked off that that are needed by the safety department. They're also working with Bruderhof to plan for the demolition, because Bruderhof is doing that work in kind, which is really, really great of them. They're meeting about that on Friday. They're also trying to coordinate a bunch of steps related to the demo, so doing neighborhood outreach or coordinating neighborhood outreach, getting a list of on-site volunteers and the schedule to our insurance department, and working to get the permit. So when all of that is done, we're looking at demo to start this month. That's the goal. Then there was also an RFP that was out for a consultant to help apply for HHAP funding. That was finished, and our goal is to get a contract and a resolution by mid-month together for you all for next month. We also have an RFP open for the operator, and those responses are due mid-month as well. And then the team is working to get the contract together with the City of Kingston and the state for the funding that both entities are providing.
Any questions on Elizabeth Manor? Legislator Erner.
Thanks. This is just down the street from where I live. It's in my district. Can I be included on the neighborhood outreach?
Yes, definitely.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll make sure that Nate has you.
Yeah, and if you could please include me as well.
Sure.
I have to double check the redistricting, but that might be my hood as well next year.
it would be.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure, definitely.
Either your hood.
Quality in.
Well, before you go to that.
Just one more question. In the RFP, was there a time frame, you know, as to when construction might start, how quickly we can get the engineering and design done?
So we're looking for construction to start, I think, in, say, another year to start renovation. I think several months from now, because we have to apply for the HHAP funding, and we have to make sure that the whole project is funded before we actually start construction. So unfortunately, this one is a longer-term project.
So we're...
We have $57 million if we get stuck. Is that something we could consider? I mean, I hate to hold it up because...
Yeah.
Of,
could we potentially lose that funding if we already pay for it?
That's true, too.
Yeah, I think that's something that we would all want to weigh against the timeline, the long timeline of applying for HHAP funding. So we can definitely talk about that.
Okay.
But if we want to go for that funding, it's a long process.
Yeah.
You have to put it off years. People need places to live.
It's been, I think, now over a year since we were there for the press conference about moving forward with this project.
Yeah.
I would like to echo Legislator Petit's point about how we can expedite this.
Yes, we can. I mean, I know that the team has been working as fast as they can on these steps, but the HHAP, if there's something that we can do to expedite that, or if there's some way we can move further, faster without that, I'll look into it.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like with the fund, like if it's going to be emergency housing, wouldn't we be able to in a much shorter timeline, just establish it as a hotel and put people in there on hotel vouchers that we're using currently at the roadway?
I think HHEC is for construction. So it there are some changes to the building that need to be made in order for it to become licensable by OPDAS. Right? That was our recollection.
Yeah, that's correct. In order for it to be a licensed shelter and eligible for the HHAP funding, it has to be specifically for purposes that are for a shelter.
So maybe you could give us the cost of
each of those.
Separate that out so that we could evaluate whether the benefit in terms of decreases in those vouchers, funds expenditures, might be offset by going ahead and using county funds to move forward.
I'll also add, Legislator Erner is spearheading right now a letter that the legislature is going to provide to the state legislature for things that we want to see change, including some legislation that's in the works right now. This process is part of the insidious structure that puts people in hotels and nowhere else, right? I mean, we can't put people in boarding homes. This used to be a boarding home. We can't put people in boarding homes. We, you know, it's very hard to put people in permanent housing. It's hard for the county to take on these capital projects. It seems like we have more red tape than the private sector has. It seems like the system is set up for people to live in hotels for the rest of their lives. And this is something that I want to add to our letter, so that we can ask for this process to be overhauled, streamlined, to make it a quicker pathway for us to be able to provide emergency housing.
The simplification of the HHAP application?
Both of them, potentially, Yeah, and so I really, that's not a complaint for the county. That's a complaint for the state and a frustration and if you could make a note of that, Jay, and then we'll get Michael and everyone together to make sure we can incorporate that. Legislator Erner, are you cool with that?
Yes.
I think we would want to have Nate in that conversation because he's been coordinating the whole HHAP application process and has experience in it, and I think could inform the ways that it could be improved.
Great. Awesome. Thank you so much. All right. So then, I'll let you lead from there. Thank you.
Sure. So quality in is the next one. We're finalizing the contract between the town and the county for our funding of the sewer and water extension. Supervisor Quigley has a final contract with all the discussed revisions, and he's indicated that it'll be signed and delivered to us soon. And that contract would run until next July 2024. We've confirmed that the town is now in contract for engineering services for the water and sewer and other needs. And then as far as the actual big milestone, they're looking to begin construction on Quality Inn by the fall of 2023. So in between that, we have to get the right of way, we have to secure various permissions, make plans, construction specifications, bid out the project and all that.
Any questions from the committee on this topic?
Just to clarify that the construction is, again, in this case, is renovations?
This is actual, renovations of the
existing structure. We're not taking down any sections of the building?
Actually, I should not guess. I need to ask that.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I haven't been involved at that level. But
my sense of it was that the building was in good enough shape that it would be renovations, but we can clarify.
Legislator Erner.
Just a comment that peripherally related. Legislators Petit and Cahill and I have a letter concerning the traffic safety in that area, and we didn't mention the project. It's another thing to send to the state to encourage NYSDOT to do what needs to be done, considering there's already a lot of people walking from the other motels around there. And so I don't know if there's a way to incorporate the executive team's work on this and lend your voice. I'll also invite other colleagues. I'm actually not sure. Legislator Petit, do we know if that letter went out yet or if it's been circulated?
don't think it went out.
Okay.
Yeah, so but it was circulated. Didn't you ask to sign on to it?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Fantastic. Okay.
Yeah, it was circulated.
I missed it.
Yeah.
So maybe you can make sure
that
I'm on
it. Can you have it sent out to the
yep.
committee?
But,
thank you.
Also, I do know that Planning Director Doyle has been looking at pedestrian traffic to that site, and so it would be good to bring him in to look at maybe what the draft is and incorporate any of his insights. So if there's the potential to really greatly improve bike ped access from that section of the county into the city of Kingston, and we should do everything we can
mm-hmm.
to take advantage of that.
Yeah. Okay.
I do want to ask about the timeline for this as well. You know, it's been, I think, 2 years since the press conference on this one. Is there anything that's going on that is slowing it down? Anything that we can do to help?
Not that I mean, I've been trying to figure that out if there's any kind of delay. I haven't heard affirmatively that there has been a specific delay. So I think that they're just going through all of these steps and processes, and it just unfortunately takes time.
I thought they said 2 years. Didn't they say two more years on this too?
Well,
four?
Till completion,
yeah.
But they're going to start construction end of 2023.
Okay.
Any other questions on the quality end? All right, I'll let you go from there.
Sure. The affordable rental upgrade campaign update is pretty fast. We've published an RFP for an organization to operate that, and those submissions are due March 17th.
Okay. Cool.
There's a lot due March 17th. I feel like I just named like three things, but
should
it's all coming together mid-March.
Yeah. Says Kathleen O'Nolan.
And then if you can share with us just a top level with the Golden Hill Penrose project,
sure.
And if it's a bigger thing, I realize I'm putting you on the spot about that.
No, it's okay. I mean, I think that will be a bigger conversation, but the top level is that they've been trying to negotiate a pilot agreement with the city, and that process has been ongoing since, I think, February of 2020, I shouldn't guess on the timeline, but for a while, there's been a number of rounds going back and forth. The city has asked for certain changes, so I think this is maybe the fourth round or so, third or fourth round. Penrose just sent another offer to the city today, trying to incorporate some of their concerns, so we're hopeful that that'll be acceptable to the city, and then that way we can move forward to the next stage of them trying to close the financing gap,
right.
And then moving towards construction.
I'll address the pilot first. This is a pilot that is only between the developer and the city. This is not a deviated pilot that has to then go to all the taxing jurisdictions?
Correct. Yeah, it's just with the city.
Got it. The financing gap, what method are they, how are they going to close the financing gap?
They're looking at every possible source. They're applying to HCR sources, HHAP, Federal Home Loan Bank. They're looking at, really any, there's like 12 sources that they're trying to cobble together to make this work. We're also looking for maybe one of our state or federal representatives would be able to help. So looking at every possibility.
Legislator Erner?
And part of the project included some roadway improvements that we budgeted for. Can those go ahead, whatever stage the rest of the project is at?
I don't know. I would think that the whole project would need to be approved before moving on any pieces of it, because I think the reason that those pieces were agreed to was, you know, in anticipation of the additional traffic that would be coming as a result of the project. So that I would think we need to get approval on the whole thing first.
Okay.
Or figure out how to finance the whole thing.
Any other questions on Golden Hill Penrose? All right. Is there anything else that you want to cover before we move into our agenda?
No.
All right. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it. And Commissioner McDonald as well. Thank you both. With that, we will go into our resolutions, right? That's the next thing on the agenda. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The first one is resolution number 76, establishing a policy requiring consideration of food security initiatives as a condition of receiving Ulster County funding for affordable housing development and certain county capital construction projects. Can I have a minute? Thank you, Legislator Nolan. Have a second?
A second.
Petite on the second there. All right. Now, this is sponsored by legislators Hansett and Sperry. They're not here, but is there anyone that wants to speak on this?
I haven't spoken with them in detail about this, but Legislator Sperry told me that she was going to bring forward this resolution, and you know, I think it's really an appropriate type of planning policy for us to have. The policy requires consideration of making food security initiatives a part of county work. And it reminds me of what we did with the Complete Streets policy some years ago, where we said if we were going to do a new bridge or road, we should consider pedestrian and bicycle access. Didn't require us to put it on, but if you consider it at the time that you're moving forward, you can sometimes incorporate it very seamlessly. And so I read through this very eagerly, and I think it looks very good. So I would be prepared to move it forward. I'm not sure if would it go to any other committees? It goes to economic development later this evening, I guess.
And it does
and
say it goes
and
through
means.
Ways and means,
yeah.
Which I'm surprised by because I don't see a financial impact here.
It doesn't have a financial impact, but, I wish that I had thought to call the sponsors and see if there was anything specific to bring up, but it's not urgent that we move it forward, but I also don't see any reason not to.
Yeah. Legislator Erner?
I did talk with Legislator Sperry a bit about it, and I want to co-sponsor it, actually. I think this is a great idea.
Yeah, that was my thought, that I would like to be on it as a co-sponsor, but I didn't have a chance to talk to the sponsors to ask them if they wanted that.
So essentially, if someone gets county funding for a housing project, it would then need to be either put in a food pantry or a community garden or that sort of, okay.
Wouldn't have to put it in, would have to
consider
whether
where
it could be put in,
okay.
And what would be the advantages and disadvantages.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very first step in the sense it's not
mm-hmm.
very, it doesn't force any particular action other than taking into consideration whether you can provide for food security at the same time you're providing for housing security. And that just seems to make great sense.
It does, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
If I may, my initial concern reading through this, my initial concern was alleviated by the fact that you can just not do it as long as you explain why you're not doing it. My kind of broad concern, and this is more around the conversation that we're having around food. I mean, this has to do with food insecurity. This has to do with how much we rely on nonprofits. This has to do with how much we rely on mutual aid. Is, you know, we're kind of normalizing as a regular function that people require food pantries, which is not something that in a perfect world, we'd either all be at food pantries or no one would be at food pantries, right? The fact that there's like a kind of set of people in our community that we're kind of just at peace with relying on food pantries, I think is a concern for me, and that we're going to, you know, that like our initiative when we're addressing a population that would qualify for affordable housing shouldn't be to figure out how they can live in poverty, but to figure out how they can escape poverty. So I have concerns about normalizing food pantries as like a goal. Like food pantries are a means to an end that shouldn't be necessary, right? So that's kind of my concern. Although I'm happy to support this, and I agree that it will be helpful, because that's the situation that we're in.
So I read this just a slightly differently, which is that we would always make food security part of our consideration. And that could be just having non-motorized access to a grocery store that provides high-quality food, which, you know, it doesn't. So I think that it doesn't restrict us to linking food pantries and free distribution of food to a certain population.
Well, I guess to build on that, I would just say I don't think food pantries are food security. Right?
Yes.
If you're going to a food pantry, you don't have food security. And so I think, you know, gardens are food security. I think access to transportation, to a, you know, to affordable food is security. I have a number of, in my district, I have a couple of those free fridges, and I have a couple of those freestanding, they look like those little libraries, those my little libraries, but they're actually food pantries. I have a few of those. And I would hate to see $200 of lumber from Home Depot in front of every single one of the affordable housing projects that we're contributing to being the answer to this resolution. Because I could see that being the answer, and that's my discomfort. But
just one final iteration on that would be: I think what this would require us to do is look at that, and if that was going to be the answer, maybe come up with a better solution as part of the planning process. So I don't see this as pushing us towards the least secure source of food, but that we have to consider it. Otherwise, we might miss it and miss an opportunity to do something. You know, in some sites, you might be able to do quite a large community garden and have a very different perspective on food. So this is just asking us to think through things. And I think the complete streets policy is one example. I think the other policy is from the environmental committee, the policy that we consider rooftop solar or solar on site with any county building that we have, because if you don't consider it, you might miss an opportunity.
Any other discussion?
That's what I compared it to. Was the exact, it was the solar. It was consideration of looking at it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great. All right. Well, I'm comfortable with us moving forward with this. It sounds like folks on the committee are. So I'll call the question. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Yes. All right, resolution number 77, establishing a policy to prioritize the mental and behavioral health needs of Ulster County residents, of Ulster County, by initiating assessment and determining a five-year plan. Can I have a motion to discuss?
Motion.
Moved
second.
By Carson, second by Nolan. Again, similar to the last one, the sponsor isn't here, but I did speak with her a bit, but I'm happy to defer to anyone who wants to speak on this. Yes, Legislator Erner?
I mean, you should go ahead. If you have something to say, then I can ask after that.
Yeah, I'll just share. This is something that Legislator Walter has been working on for a while. She sends her regrets for not being able to attend. I think this is, you know, definitely a worthwhile endeavor, and it sets in motion us kind of really understanding the larger picture here. And when you talk to folks that are navigating the mental and behavioral needs system, it's a complicated system, and so I think there, even if it's just helping people understand the totality of it, I could see that being worthwhile. Yep. Hold on, before we go to Deputy Executive Wolf.
Yeah, I support this. I think some of the language in here is a little more leading or conclusory than I would like in terms of it seems to convey that that privatization is a problem, and that providing county services is a solution. And I think that that is sometimes the case, and I'm not sure it's always the case. So the study itself would help us answer that question, and I'm not going to argue for changes in whereases, but I think we should, if we're looking for information, we should go into that inquiry with a neutral, open perspective. Otherwise, we can end up concluding what we already knew, and then I don't want to spend money to do that. But I think that the study, if well designed, will give us information about where we have good investments to make by moving towards a county managed system, and I have supported it almost every time that's come up. I mean, can't think of a time when I haven't in this term and my prior term in the legislature. However, I do hold open that little, null hypothesis that there might be a time when the study would say, oh, you've really done something that has improved the system and saved money for the larger community by going with a private source. I looked a couple of times to see if there were specific changes that I could make, and it just seemed like it's not worth the effort, but I did want to make the comment.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Legislator Petit?
I have a financial question. Studies cost money. The one that they're doing for the Reuse Innovation Center, $75,000, and I don't see a financial impact
so
yet.
Would
it come from the opioid money?
I don't know the answer to that second question, although someone here might, maybe Joanna knows when we go to her in a second, but Commissioner McDonald or anyone, but I will note that I did discuss the financial impact with Legislator Walter, and it was intentional that a financial dollar figure was not put on this, because we don't want, it's like going onto a used car lot and saying, I've got $30,000, do you have a car for me? And they'd say, I have one that costs just that amount. So we don't want someone coming back for the RFP and saying, oh, it turns out this study costs exactly that amount.
But we've brought that up before. You know, and so is it a $10,000 study that we're okaying, or a $200,000?
Well, we don't have to award the RFP. Just because we get an RFP doesn't mean, just because we get quotes,
okay,
doesn't mean we have to award it to someone. It's not a blank check. It's just saying, you tell us how much you think this is going to cost, knowing that it's a competitive bid. And I personally, when I, ran my own business, and I do again now, this is how I would approach it personally. But I realize that not everything in the private sector translates over, so I'm very open to other thoughts about this.
Yeah, I think if your scope of what you want to have the responses be is clear enough, then you don't get into a problem. If it's not very clear, then you will get proposals for $10,000 and for $200,000, and then you have a different kind of process for determining what you want and coming back to us. I'm comfortable from our perspective here. This will be looked at in Ways and Means, and I imagine there'll be further conversation about it.
Yeah. So two things about that. Number one, I really, for this committee and all committees of original jurisdiction, I feel very strongly that we should answer as many of the substantive, questions about policy and about these programs in these committees. We should, ask those questions here. But a question about the cost, I am very happy to let them argue about in Ways and Means. And I think that they will, and I hope that they do.
I can yield to Legislator Erner, but then I have another thought.
Yeah, Legislator Erner.
So speaking of Ways and Means, maybe the chair can explain, if he knows, the reasoning why the chair of the legislature would be who looks at the RFP before it's public, or their designee, not Ways and Means, or not this committee.
I don't know the answer to that. Legislator Walter would be the best person to ask. I will, note that it has gotten complicated when we, if we could go back and do the eviction services RFP again, I would probably suggest we do it slightly differently. It got a little bit confusing having the committee be the review board for that. So I could certainly see the case to be made for having it be the chair or her designee. But I think that's a valid question to ask for sure. Yep. Legislator Nolan?
Yeah, I think the chair could designate somebody from this committee, for example, if there's a subject matter specialist on the committee. The other comment I was going to make about the financials is that I think it would be helpful for the sponsor to identify possible sources of funding that might be commensurate with the expected range of prices that this might cost. So as we were talking, could it be covered by the opioid response funds? And perhaps that would help the Ways and Means Committee feel more comfortable moving forward if there are funding sources that could cover generally the range that we think the proposals might come back in.
All right, with that, I'm sorry to make you wait, Deputy Executive Contreras, if you want to weigh in on this, we'd love to hear.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no problem. I was just going to say generally that we support this. I think it's important to have a roadmap, especially when it comes to something as complicated as substance use disorder and mental health and what we want to do for the next 5 years. There's so many opportunities to start new initiatives and programs, and we're doing so much of that it makes sense to try to put it all together in a strategic plan. Tara had already started drafting this RFP, actually. But I think that your point that you just made is really, really helpful in that we would want to craft the RFP in as very neutral, as neutral language as possible, so that we're not actually moving towards a foregone conclusion, but we're actually opening it up to a thorough review and recommendations.
Yep. And the creation of the RFP, the way this is worded, is going to continue to be in the executive branch of government. It's not okay, it's not going to be our RFP.
No.
Yeah. So they'd be able to do that.
Yep. Good.
All right. Any other discussion? Otherwise, I'll call the question on this. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Great. Resolution number 91, amending the 2023 Ulster County budget, Department of Social Services. Can I have a motion to discuss? Thank you, Legislator Nolan.
Okay.
And a second from Legislator Petit. And I will defer to Commissioner Iaposi to give us some background here.
Okay. I think attached to the resolution was a list of the specific budget adjustments that we were requesting. And, I mean, for purposes of context, this is something that we do on an annual basis, and I think some of the narratives address the fact that some of it is driven by the state's fiscal year and program years with regard to some of these specific amounts of money. Also, it's less than 1% of our budget, so to the degree that there are specific reasons programmatically for each of the adjustments which are provided in the narrative, it's relatively speaking a small number of programs. I mean, just as an example, because I think Raise the Age is a program that people have some familiarity with. That's a program that generally runs from October 1st to September 30th. So we're actually just finishing the first quarter of the services under that program. And our plans were approved at the end of last year, and we implemented services for that. So we're actually just starting to receive the invoices, but we got the funds at the end of last year. So with regard to all of these adjustments, they have similar features that are the reasons for why we're asking for them. And obviously, if there's anything more specific that people are interested in knowing about, we can provide that information.
Any questions from the committee? Any points of discussion? All right. Well, with that, I will call the question on resolution number 91. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. That's unanimous. Resolution number 92, approving the execution of a contract amendment for $70,000 entered into by the county, Family of Woodstock, Department of Social Services. Can I have a motion to discuss? By Nolan, second by Petit. Thank you so much. And again, I will defer to Commissioner Iaposi to give us some background.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. I know that we had some questions around whether this increase was related to the living wage that had been implemented or any other specific kind of programmatic cost. And the answer that we had provided to that question was that it was not. It was essentially as a result in an additional number of bed days at the facilities Darmstadt and Family Inn. And the reason for that was during 2022, some of the COVID-related capacity restrictions were relaxed. So what happened was that our original contract anticipated that it would be a number of bed days similar to what was able to be provided in 2021. And the fact that some of those COVID restrictions were relaxed actually allowed for the expansion of available bed days there by opening up some more beds as a result. space that had previously not been available due to COVID restrictions. So that's what that specifically is attributable to.
Legislative Petit.
And how does this translate into extra, you know, individuals? How many extra people? Did they give you an increase? Yeah. Through the chair.
It basically means that in terms of the volume of clients we were seeing that we would be placing at the shelters who presented as emergency homeless, we were able to extend some of the placements there and add some placements. So more services were provided in terms
okay.
of being able to have more space available.
Not necessarily there. More people.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And this is the one that's backdated. Right? Like
yes.
It goes into 2022. That's why there's that adjustment is significant.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Legislator Erner.
Thank you. I have several questions and concerns here. Not so much about this specific change, but overall with, so Darmstadt is in my district, and so I have more contact perhaps than most do with the people who are spending time there. Mm-hmm. And like, can we get Family of Woodstock or other contractors like they are in here to ask them questions? The reason I have questions for them is I see on the scope of services what DSS is asking them to do, but it actually doesn't go into a whole lot of information about the program and their rules and things like that. And when I hear constituent concerns, that's usually the concerns that I'm hearing about. So I guess that's my first question. Would it be possible to ask the contractor to come so that they can answer our questions?
That's not a decision that
we can
make,
and they will.
I think they can be invited.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would just add that if there are questions, if they can be provided with specificity, because there are some program requirements that I think would be relevant to being able to respond to those questions, so that they could bring those program requirements and provide them in connection with their explanations for why there are certain requirements. It's an important question, and it also arrives at being able to respond to why some emergency homeless clients are not amenable to being placed at Darmstadt. There are a lot of rules and regulations that license shelters with regard to many activities, and some individuals experience challenges being able to comply with those rules and regulations. So I think it's an important issue to address, but they are driven by specific requirements that licensed shelters have to comply with.
So, Legislator Erner, I'm happy to work with you to make sure that we can ask those questions for the contractor directly. So whether we're inviting them here or we set something up for you to be able to meet with them, I'm positive that they will meet with you.
Okay, and then I have a couple other questions that
the
contractor wouldn't be answering necessarily. So, in the commissioner of DSS's opinion, could someone have this as the only option that they were offered from DSS as a placement? Say, let me just get specific without identifying somebody here. Like, somebody gets evicted and they present to DSS, they need emergency housing. Is this ever the only place that they would be offered, or would they potentially be offered something else if they didn't want to go here?
You know, each of those scenarios is going to be evaluated, you know, on its particular facts and circumstances. If we have a client arrive and in connection with the interview that takes place and we identify that they're presenting with specific needs that would be able to be supported by placement at Darmstadt, which provides support, oversight, meals, we would potentially, particularly if we had vacancies there, encourage placement at Darmstadt. I think you're very familiar with the fact that some individuals are not amenable to placement at Darmstadt, and they will indicate that they have mental health diagnoses, health considerations and preferences that do not make that a viable option for them.
we will consider those in the context of the interview that's taking place. We will also look at what the circumstances are regarding other available options. We sometimes have individuals that might not be able to be accommodated elsewhere because of other events and circumstances around their placements at alternative options. It's a case-by-case basis, Legislature Ernest, and I would say that in the normal course of business, we would always seek to place someone at Darmstadt because of the supportive services that are available there for individuals that are presenting, and you know, being able to be at that placement normally will create the most possibilities, you know, for stabilization, for addressing other collateral issues. So that would be my response.
And as far as the family, what parameters determines, like, can you put multiple generations of adults with grandchildren at the family inn?
It depends on how the family presents. If we have a grandparent who presents that has custody of their grandchildren, that's a family unit. So they would be eligible for placement at the family inn. I mean, a family as it presents, and depending upon what the availability in terms of accommodations are. Again, and you know, I think I would invite the executive director of Family of Woodstock and the facility managers to provide more specifics. But again, it's going to be on a case-by-case basis.
Okay, one more question.
Go ahead.
So I had 17 registered voters at between those two facilities as of 2 years ago, and there's four who joined and then three who left that list as of last year. And I see here we're ideally supposed to be having plans for folks to move on from there after 90 days, but DSS can make an exception. It seems like we're having folks stay there for an awful long time. Can you comment on why that might be?
Because there's not affordable housing inventory for them to be able to transition into. Generally, the answer. Which, again, I mean, we've had conversations about the linkages between emergency housing and permanent housing, you know, and that's obviously one of the dynamics. You know, we have been experiencing longer duration of stay in emergency housing than we previously did because of the lack of available and affordable inventory for people to transition into.
If I may on that, it might also be worth asking that question of the Board of Elections, because I think if you could imagine an accommodation being made to a population that was somewhat transient, that they could vote, so they could put in, if they have spent a lot, you know, been in and out of the shelter and are trying to get on their feet, we don't want to disenfranchise them, because you have to register so early, you know, before you can vote, that it might just be... there might be, I don't want to say an accommodation, but there might be data, feedback from the Board of Elections on how they handle things that might help on that question.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Yep. Director, Deputy Executive.
I just wanted to request if you end up setting up a meeting with Michael Berg, if I could join. I just end up learning a lot in any of these conversations, so if you're open to that, I would like
to. Absolutely.
Yep. We'd be happy for that, yeah. All right. Any other discussion on resolution number 92 before we call the question? All right, and I will call the question on resolution 92. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, that is unanimous. Before we go on to resolution number 93, if it's all right with the committee, I'm going to ask if we can take one item from the end of the agenda out of order. We have our legislative counsel, Rigucci, here. He is here for one purpose and one purpose only, which is to tell us about this one specific thing, and I feel very badly that we were making him hang out in the building when he could go home. So if it's all right with everyone, I want to quickly address, and we don't have to take any action on it, but quickly address resolution number 200 of 2022. We don't need to move it. I'm just going to read it, but we don't need a motion to move it. It's setting a public hearing on proposed law number 7 of 2022, local law amending the code of the County of Ulster in relation to evictions. And I would like to give the floor to Councilor Bergucci to explain to us about the ethics opinion that we received on Friday about our question as to whether landlords and or tenants can vote on matters affecting the regulation of housing.
Thank you, Chair. You should tell, and I appreciate the word, although I am always happy to stay
noted.
An issue arose during an early debate regarding the proposed local law that you just mentioned. We obviously amended our ethics law last year. It was the intent for that committee and then the eventual law that was passed to permit the legislature, obviously, to act in matters like the matter that was addressed in the good cause eviction law, which was the basis for the inquiry. To that end, we submitted a request to the ethics board after the ethics law was amended, just to seek confirmation that they did not see any issue with the legislature, particularly those members that would fall under the ambit, arguably, of the good cause eviction law, to deliberate and vote upon the law. Obviously, the good cause eviction law affects landlords and tenants, which I don't have a count offhand, but I suspect would be many of the members of the body. And as you can see from the letter dated February 23rd, 2023, the ethics board has taken, in my view, respectfully, an extremely broad interpretation of the ethics law. The ethics board, as they submit in paragraph 2, finds that any legislator who owns or rents a housing accommodation and acts upon the proposed law would, according to the ethics board, be contravening the ethics law. As a preliminary matter, I would say with all respect that I disagree with their findings. To find this conclusion in the ethics law as written in 2022, I think is a bit of an overreach and too broad of an interpretation. Essentially, the interpretation leaves the legislature handcuffed in basically any action relating to matters that affect landlords and or tenants, as I said, which is a large majority, my understanding anyway, of the body. To that end, there are several avenues that we could potentially take, and I'm happy to discuss that. I don't know if Chair Uchtel wants me to go into them at this juncture, but I just, at this point, wanted to present the letter that we just received, that I just received, and obviously voice my concern with their findings and disagreement from a legal perspective. And I would also note, finally, in the last paragraph of their letter, I will quote, they say, the board believes that this raises a concern regarding the ethics law's impact on the legislature's ability to debate this and other important matters. Obviously, respectfully, I would agree with that sentiment. For example, as written, the law could theoretically hamper the legislature's ability to vote on tax matters or business regulation matters, as those issues could conceivably could have a conceivable indirect pecuniary or material benefit to all members of the legislature. Now, obviously, respectfully, obviously, I disagree with them, but I think their last paragraph actually confirms the erroneous nature of their finding in the paragraph above, and that it's too broad of an interpretation. But again, as we all know, lawyers can have differing opinions on the same issue. So, to that end, I mean, that leaves us, I think, in a position where we have to take some affirmative action, the steps of which will be determined by the members, obviously, to fix this issue one way or the other.
And so if I may, just to kind of recap, what I'm reading is that they're not just saying landlords and tenants can't vote on matters. They're saying anyone who owns a home, right, or is a tenant, or is a landlord. And so that's everybody. I mean, that is, we have a lot of landlords in the legislature, but we have a lot of people that live in homes, I think all of us, in fact. And I think that's wild, especially considering that we amended our ethics law to what we thought was to clarify that only a direct benefit to a specific company, a specific property, would be considered, you know, to be afoul of the ethics law. And now this is a very broad interpretation. So if no one has any objection, I would like to hear from Counselor Verducci on potential paths forward, unless anyone wants to comment on this before we hear from him. Yep, Legislator Nolan.
Well, I would just add, I read this last paragraph, and it says that this, their interpretation of the law would theoretically hamper the legislature's ability to vote on tax matters or business regulation matters. It basically is saying that anything that we do that has an important effect on the businesses and people in the community, it raises ethical problems. And this is an interpretation that has been there have been cases brought in relationship to service of farmers on boards in towns where they're going to be having to deal with agricultural matters. So there's, in other areas of law, there is case law that says you should not interpret the law in a way that prevents any participation by members of the community in the laws and regulations of their community. So I think their interpretation runs counter to reason on the first level, but also to establish law in some other areas. And I don't know if there's any law, particularly related to municipal governance, legislative functions. So I think that it is problematic. They do seem to imply that there is a way to draft the ethics law that would avoid this problem, but we already tried to do that. So I too am interested in possible solutions, and just think that we should work in a way that goes most quickly to try to escape this very very tight understanding of potential conflict of interest that would invalidate any person that we can imagine from being able to serve and take vote and make votes on an issue. You that's an unacceptable outcome.
I agree respectfully, and from a legal perspective and a theoretical perspective, and I would also note that this finding prevents the legislature from performing acts that we are duty-bound to perform by the charter expressly, by the way, including taxing and spending, obviously. To that same point, obviously no one wants to perpetrate an ethics violation. Right, so I agree with you. We have to fix it. I think one thing to be wary of, and Commissioner Iposi may remember this from law school, is that anytime you get into a position of where you start listing or ticking off specific things in a statute, it ends up excluding other things. And that is very problematic from a legal perspective, which is why we drafted specifically what I thought was, in conjunction with minority counsel and a working group, what I thought was broad language, which covered us in this way. And has actually covered other municipalities in similar ways that are in similar situations. So to your point, I think we could potentially attempt to amend again the ethics law. I think we may have to with this broad approach that the ethics board is taking. Other than amending the law, I'm not sure exactly what steps we have. I mean, we have to act as a legislative body in an efficient and appropriate way. We have to take action way on all matters as charged by the charter. So I think we have to amend the law and amend it quickly. And obviously I'm happy to do whatever to get that done.
So I would agree with that approach, and I think that we could look perhaps to some of those cases in zoning issues that are similar for language that might be just exemption language. So whatever we say about, conflict of interest and pecuniary interest in general, we could potentially add language that says, with the exception that legislative functions to regulate, the broad spheres of action of the community are exempted.
Laws of general applicability.
General applicability, exactly.
Which is exactly what we
tried to
do.
This is news. This is new to this last couple of days. So we're gonna
I mean, I've not really discussed it with anyone yet, and I wanted to make sure that, because the chair shared it with everyone yesterday, that we made sure to address it in this committee. All right. Everyone cool with moving on from there?
And obviously, if anyone has any follow-up questions, feel free to give me a call. I'm happy to talk through.
Yep. Legislator Erner?
I mean, I'm just going to guess that this committee will have no appetite to contravene this decision and just move ahead and ignore it.
This decision is not the only one that leads to some unanswered questions about the ability of a county to implement a good cause eviction law. So as the author, even I am apprehensive about moving forward. The city of Kingston, you know, has the law. The way that it's being implemented is, you know, of unclear impact, I would say. The other municipalities that have implemented laws are in court. It's not been going great. And I think we have some momentum in the state legislature on this. So that's where I'm at on it. I will, of course, defer to the will of the body, but as the sponsor, not speaking as the chair, but as the sponsor, that's the way that I'm doing it. Anyone else want to weigh in? Otherwise, I would have us move forward in the agenda.
If those other paths were not in motion, then I think we might be forced to try to do something else. But I think that moving forward in a way that causes an ethics violation to be filed against every member of the body would lead to really just drama and not really solve the problem when we'd be in court and spending money that we should be using on housing. So it's unfortunate, but we could make it worse, and I think we shouldn't do that.
Any further discussion? All right. Thank you so much, Councilor.
My pleasure.
I very much appreciate it. Thank you.
And
thank you, everyone, for the flexibility on the agenda. I should have thought of this at the beginning and done it right at the beginning. So. All right, with that, we're going to move on to resolution number 93, amending the 2023 Ulster County budget to accept increased funding from the New York State Office of Mental Health for supportive housing, personalized recovery-oriented services, and to amend the funding for Community Support Programs Department of Mental Health. Can I have a motion to discuss? Moved by Corcoran. Can I have a second? Second by Petit. And I will defer to Commissioner McDonald to give us a very brief background, although this is accepting money, so we're probably not going to have too much pushback for you.
That's basically it. I mean, the state, what I can say is that the state is changing its methodology and its fiscal model for a broad number of programs. And we've been already given enough a heads up that we're going to be getting multiple amendments to our state aid letter. So I can just tell you that this is going to be happening quite a bit. And this is the first of many. So they're giving additional funding to supportive housing, which is always a good thing. And they've changed the methodology proposed as well, which will allow for them to bill in a different manner.
Great. Any questions from the committee? Legislator Petit?
Generally, we have a matrix on here. This is 100% federal funding or state funding?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah,
we don't have the matrix
yeah,
on at this time.
But
or is it on the back?
It's in the appropriation statement.
Revenue
dollars.
Oh, okay. So the matrix apparently is just for contracts. So accepting funding when it's not linked to a contract is not in the matrix form.
Thank you.
Yeah. The matrix, for those who don't know what the heck we're talking about, is when we get the resolutions and they have this little grid here that say where the funding is and what it is, what the everything, which is super helpful, I will just say. It's kind of like how they say, what do they say, undergrads read all the text and don't read any of the diagrams, and grad students only read the diagrams and don't read any of the text.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what that
depends
about.
On what kind of mood I'm in, yeah.
All right, so with that, I'll call a question on resolution number 93. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, that's unanimous. We'll move on to resolution number 94, approving the execution of a contract amendment for $60,000 entered into by the county with Resource Center for Accessible Living, Office for the Aging.
I'll move it.
All right, second.
Second
from Corcoran, moved by Nolan.
All right, Sue, if you want to give us some general background.
Sure. In case everybody isn't aware, ARCAL is one of our partners in the community that does a lot of home accessibility modifications for our clients and sometimes people who are not our clients. We got a lot of money from NYSOFA from various places over the last year, and we needed to spend it. And when people came to us with requests to build or fix or modify their entrances to their homes or widen their doorways, things like that, we were able to call the ARCAL to help us. So this is something they do for us anyway, but it's a larger amount this time, and it's just trying to spend the money as quickly as we can. I know it's a terrible thing to be able to do, to help folks remain in their homes, which is our mission.
That's great.
And that's really all this is. It doesn't move very quickly, but it does move, and it keeps people at home. So.
Any questions? The legislator Erner?
Yes, thank you. Let's see, there's something on here in the scope of services around asking. So I see about at least 100 seniors would be served if we got $60K in 3 months. Is that,
no,
am I reading
that
right?
No, that's not going to happen.
It's not.
100 people? No. I know. It would be great, but I don't know where that came from, but that's pretty optimistic.
$60K, anything exceeding $600, they would need approval. But
then
you will approve, probably.
Then. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of hard to get anything done with $600. I mean, you might be able to do some grab bars, you know, raise toilet seat, things like that for $600. Any kind of construction is in the thousands. So.
Can I ask another question?
Yep, go ahead.
Sure.
Okay. So I'm reading the state's description here, Area Agencies on Aging, and it says if an AAA chooses to provide ancillary services. So that kind of baffled me, but I mean, I'm not asking you to get in the state's head, but how did we choose that we would do this? Or suppose we didn't do that, like who wouldn't choose to
do
it?
Well, there are some projects that were presented to us, and I'll give you one specific example this year that we couldn't pick up. And it was a woman who lived down in Napanock, who lived in a trailer. And the roof of her trailer was almost completely shot. It was covered with like a tarp. And you cannot address the repairs on that through a program like this if they don't own the land that the trailer is on. And I know there's something about, you know, she owns the trailer itself. There were other problems with the trailer. It was full of mold. It was full of mildew. It was full of moisture because of this roofing problem. All the moisture was going. She didn't want to leave. You know, she refused to leave. She wanted to help other people. I mean, a woman has a heart of gold. She was not one of our clients. But this came from somebody in the community asking us to help. And we couldn't justify doing that because we couldn't do the work on it, nor could we find anybody to do it because of the ownership of the land, of this funny thing about owning the land and not owning the land, renting the land and owning the trailer. So it would have been different if she had owned the land. We could have maybe put a pot of money to fix the trailer, but it wasn't really worth fixing. It should have been condemned, and she wasn't willing to leave or do anything. That's a case where we wouldn't choose to do anything. Things come to us that we try to get done, but again, ARCAL has a limited amount of resources as well. So they have a guy who goes out, he assesses what they need to be done, he gives us a ballpark figure about how much it might cost. He has connections in the community for people to do the work, and then comes back to us if the budget that they come up has to be adjusted, it'll be adjusted a little bit. We approve each step of the way. And it's usually sometimes, I would say it's between $1,000 and $15,000is where we're working. Not huge amounts of money, but, you know, reasonable amounts of money to do that kind of stuff because construction's expensive and the workman's comp is expensive and ARCAL can can kind of cover people if they're single contractors, probably more than you need to know. But those are the things that we kind of juggle around when people ask us.
Thank you.
Answer your question.
I'll share my concern here, and it's not necessarily with this contract or with the services that are being provided or even with the vendor. I have no reason to have an issue with that. But I don't see anywhere in here that says how much they're paying their employees, and I want to make sure that the workforce that's executing county programs is being paid a living wage.
All of them have to pay at least $15 an hour.
Do we have that evidenced in the contract?
All of the contracts that we did in the past will now be adjusted to that if the contract is running out and has to be renewed.
Okay.
So I was told by the purchasing department that once the contract becomes new, you know, we're doing it again, that clause is included in all of them.
But I guess this is a roundabout way of me making the point again to the entire executive branch of government, which is that my intention with Resolution 288 from 2022 that passed, and this is totally not relevant, like this is like in the weeds more for Deputy Executive Contreras, is that contracts include a sheet that stipulates the actual wage, not just that they're signing off that they're paying a livable wage, but we know what the wages are. You know, that would help us understand how much was actually going to the service workers, right? And it would also help us understand, you know, if a contract is more expensive, but we're paying people a living, $15 is barely a living wage, right? Like if we were paying a wage that you could really, you know, buy a home, like that would be significant. That's the spirit of the resolution that this legislature adopted in 2022. And it doesn't seem to be implemented just yet. I know that we're working on it, and I'm excited for that, and I'm excited to stop bringing these points up in committee.
Noted, definitely. Yes, sorry for the delay on that. I have to get with Chris, and we need to figure out how to implement this in procurement, but I got the resolution today from Jay so that we're making sure that we understand the context.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. Yes. Legislator Erner.
Thank you. Just back with the state's specifications around the program, are you aware of where they use terms such as promoting individuals' independence, having the home be safe and adequate living environment, maintaining the client in their community? I mean, I might have a sense of what those all mean, but are you aware of somewhere that the state defines those, or do we in the county have some definition of what would constitute independent living, safe and adequate environment, and so forth?
Well, I think when they go out and they assess something that needs to be done where somebody's level of independence might be impacted on how they're living now, and maybe something happened to them medically, that something has to be modified in their home. I'm sure it comes from the Older Americans Act back in '89, certainly, but NYSOFA is very much aware and puts forth very, very specific things about people being independent in their homes. So if putting in a ramp or fixing a ramp or putting a lift on a trailer, I know that trailers are not necessarily the most permanent of housing, but a lot of people live in there, and they live in there for pretty well for 30 years or so. And that makes them independent and keeps them at home, then we'll do it. That those are the kinds of things that we can help them modify to stay at home and to live at home, because what are their choices? Mike has no housing for anybody. There's no affordable housing being built for any senior citizens except once in a while. Honestly, that's the way it appears to me. So the best bet is to modify where they live to keep them independent and living at home. And even though it's maybe not the greatest bet in the world to modify the porch of a trailer or to build a ramp on a trailer, that's where their home is. And a lot of them are comfortable there, and we have to respect that. So I think it's harder to modify trailers per se than it is, what do they call it, a stick-built home, or, you know, homes where you can widen doorways. where you can smooth out the floor. So now they're in a wheelchair and they need a different way of living. That's what we use RCAL for and those services for, to make sure that anybody who is less able now can still live at home and be as independent as possible. And then we go in, I mean, if they're clients of ours, we try to do what we can through our ISAP program, which is, you know, some aides, we've talked about that before, some aides, home-delivered meals, PERS units, things like that, people going to the home to make sure that, in general, that week after week they're safe, as they can be.
I've got Legislator Petit next,
yeah.
And then Nolan.
Thank you. There's other programs out there, too. I think RUPCO has Access and the Veterans. Have you ever referred people if for some reason the RCAL program can't cover them?
Yes, we refer to RUPCO. Oh. RUPCO can put in, I think we've had people who have needed elevators on the outside of the home to be installed, which are much less expensive, obviously, than internal. And other types, that's through our New York Connects program. They have those
okay.
connections and those referral services that we can refer people for that.
Thank you.
Legislator Nolan.
Through the chair to Legislator Erner. Another perspective on the question you ask about, you know, how we understand these terms is that health professionals in various fields do have assessment tools to guide them on that. So physical therapists will have questions about whether the individual can move safely on a level ground, up and down stairs, there are different categories. And occupational therapists also, and healthcare professionals in terms of whether or not the person can handle their own inhalation treatments and things like that. So there's a group of health professional assessments that take place that lead to basically a discernment of whether somebody is capable of living independently safely. And it's not a clear-cut edge in many cases. What one individual may consider safe for herself, another individual might not, and vice versa. So it's case by case.
And in our definitions, just to add on to that, thank you, as somebody who's been in the health field for a long time, there are certain judgments that health professionals make about people who can handle their own ADLs, the activities of daily living, or the independent ADLs that we use to determine that person can still live safely at home. Right? We're not a medical model. We're not a behavioral health model or anything like that. But if they can still do things for themselves, and the only thing they might need from us is a modification, they might need some aid time. They might need meals that they can prepare for themselves, but that keeps them home and independent, then that's our role in this. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We're not a home care agency. We're not licensed. We do use licensed professionals for some things, but we do not get involved or cannot get involved in that kind of level of care. We're not prepared to do that. But we can supply things that keep them at home. And for instance, you may not think this is, you know, I might not think this is a big deal, but for some people, having somebody do the shopping and their laundry for them keeps
mm-hmm.
them at home.
Mm-hmm. For many people.
For many people, right.
Yeah.
Yep, Director Dawson.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I might be speaking at it. But while you're here with so much information, modifications, do you make modifications because you mentioned medical? If someone, for example, was an amputee and they're living in a house and they're senior and they're capable of doing things for themselves but they can't do stairs anymore, do they make modifications like for bathrooms?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of things that can be done, and one of the things that are installed might be one of those chairlifts. But then you have to think about what happens if the electric goes out, right? So what do you put in the house to make sure that doesn't stymie them in the home or trap them upstairs if there's a, you know, an electrical problem, things you have to think about. But to me, a stair lift for somebody like that would keep them independent at home. That you might not think, you might think, oh, this poor person, you know, they can't do this, they can't. Well, they can do that if they can get up and down their stairs.
What about like modifications to plumbing, like a bathroom downstairs?
Oh yeah, that's all part of what RCAL does. We might not do huge $60,000-$70,000 job.
No.
But we certainly can do things that most of the accidents that you have in your home are in the bathroom or your bedroom. So those are the places we focus on. And if people are unsafe in their bathroom, to make it safer for them to continue living there is the goal of this particular accessibility and keeping them independent.
I appreciate you.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you. All right, well, if there's no further discussion, I will call the question on, I believe, where are we at? Resolution
94.
Oh, no. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Resolution number 95, approving the execution of a contract for $106,000 entered into by the county with Unlimited Care, Inc., Office for the Aging. Can I have a motion to discuss?
So moved.
Moved by Nolan, a second by Corcoran. And before I pass it off to Director Copenhaver, to give us background, I will just point out to the committee that we approved three of these last month. This is another contract in the same program. So,
however, this one, I don't remember whether you did home health care and companion last month, but we have established two dedicated aides to these agencies. That was one of our goals. Mm-hmm. Number one, to hire our own, which we did two in the last month. Thank you to the legislature. and a case manager that were, and possibly a second. So those are all in progress. But we wanted to have somebody to go into the home that we had a little bit more control of, who is a level two personal care aide, and this is what we did with Unlimited Care. So they came to us with a proposal, we talked it over, same thing that we did with Home Health Care and Companion. That aide is dedicated to us. We came up with a contract. They make a really good wage. You were talking about a living wage then. We made sure that in the contract it says they make this much money. You know, I think it's in the 20s now per hour, which is a great wage for home care. They get mileage reimbursement, and they work for us for 40 hours a week, and we get to tell them which cases to go on. So we have a little bit more control instead of waiting for an aide to fall into our lap. So we're taking over, well, I don't want to say we're taking over, we're taking more control over of our licensed agency agreements, and they are absolutely perfectly happy to do this too, because it's guaranteed income for them. The aide gets a great wage. They don't have to worry about scheduling that person. It's a win-win for everybody.
Nice.
Great.
Thank you.
Nope.
Any questions or
discussion? Yeah, we're happy about it too.
All right, I will call the question on resolution number 95. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Our last resolution, resolution number 96, approving the execution of a contract amendment for $4,088, causing the aggregate contract plus amendment amount to be in excess of $50,000, entered into by the county with Family of Woodstock for the Youth Bureau. Can I have a motion to discuss?
I'll move it.
Moved by Nolan, seconded by Erner. And we have Director Dawson here, and I will hand it off to you to give us some very brief background.
Thank you so much. I learn so much when I come to these meetings.
We all do.
It was asked why I don't come to all of the meetings. In the past, the previous administrations, I was always told you don't need to come. So I just wanted to explain that point.
Previous.
And then the previous one before that, I came all the time. So it depends on who is here. And you guys are great, by the way. I want to first of all thank to the legislators that visited my Youth Bureau meeting. I was so happy to have them come. It was awesome. Thank you, Legislator Erner, and the other young lady, Nolan, that came. And it was really nice. It was a nice surprise. And I think that it actually taught them a little bit more about what we do. Most people don't want you to know all the details. I'm like, blah. So it doesn't matter to me. I like it. To explain this increase, this is a small one for me. Last year was a very different year in many ways. There were a lot of changes, and I believe it's going to filter over into this year. Family of Woodstock, Block is one of the contracts, one of the programs that we actually fund from the state. And there are transitions occurring right now. So the state is going from January to December, and they're going to actually end that yearly, and they're going to change over to, effective September, they're going to change over to, and I don't know why they picked these months, because it's very different. Normally it's half year, but they're going to start effective October 1st. I don't get it. I just take the funding and do the best I can with it. So, and it's going to be a tricky change, and that's part of why this happened. So normally the state tells us to just go with the less of the amount from the previous year, which I have the number embedded in my mind because I've done it for years, 151, 151. And then they changed it all of a sudden, and it like threw me off. So when we got our approval, the original amount for this was under 50,000. And this point is over 50,000. So, yeah. So that's why that $4,000 difference occurred for families with stuff. Yeah. It's just one of the 30 programs that I fund through Youth Bureau.
Thank you. Yeah. Any questions?
Thank
or,
you.
Or yep, Legislator Erner?
Thank you. I guess, Director Dawson, I'm interested in hearing an overview of how this program overall is working.
Which one?
The Family House program that this covers, and I'd be interested if we could hear perspective of the workers there, although maybe we need to go through the firm.
I can give you Family of Woodstock, Family House is one of the four programs that I fund. This particular one is one of the ones that I actually call in the instance of a runaway and homeless youth, and that's what the funding determination is. RHY is for runaway and homeless youth. I call them like I call Mike's team, like in a desperate situation, help me, I have a teenager that's out there and it's a female and I don't want her to be out there. Family House many times helps me. They'll take this teen in. And everything goes by vetting. There's always regulations and blah, blah, blah. The state comes in every year and they do visits, even check the refrigerator. So it is so closely monitored that it's mind-blowing sometimes for me. When they can help me and it's past 5 o'clock and I'm asking to get a kid off the street, this is a gift to me. So I can't put it any better than that. And it's very, very regulated. They have, they do intakes with these kids when they come in. Even though it's a kid that's like in a desperate situation, they don't just put them in a bed. They take, like the state is doing, causing more and more work, but they're securing things in a lot of ways. So Family House does a lot of work with needs for way more than they can actually handle. So, and I've utilized them, I can't tell you how many times. Yeah, so. And I mean, if you go on their site, you're going to see this is one of the programs that I really, really like. And also, transitional living is amazing, amazing. These are kids that can't get along with parents, they're homeless, but they're in high school. Transitional living is on O'Neill Street. They help these kids. I've gone there and they were baking cookies with the kids, asking me if I wanted to join in. You could look at the kid and tell that this kid's been through a rough life, but they're actually giving them a home setting that they haven't even gotten from home. So they're two great programs, and I don't sell programs very much, but those are great programs. And Ty is actually, the person that's actually the program director right now is, you ever clean up somebody else's mess? She's cleaning up somebody else's mess, and she's worked there for years, and she's doing a great job. It's a lot of work. And she comes from a background where a family member has mental health issues. So there's a relatability, which to me is priceless. So it's a great program. And go visit.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Legislator Nolan?
I was just going to say that somehow it feels like this is my favorite $4,088 to spend as a legislator.
I dabbled a little bit. I'm sorry.
I don't think that's what they're saying at all.
When I hear stuff like that, I think, oh, my job is so much easier now.
These are really, really important programs,
yeah,
and the difference they make in people's lives is enormous. So it's a great function of the county to support these programs.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, with that, I will call the question on resolution number 96. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right.
Thank you so much, Director Dawson. And generally, as you know, chair of this committee, my goal is just to have, when there are resolutions for the Youth Bureau, I like to have you here. If there's resolutions for the Office for the Aging, I like to have Director Copenhaver here. Haver.
Yeah,
oh, I'm gonna get it. I'm gonna get it. As someone with a complicated last name, I'm gonna get it. With that, we have a forthcoming resolution. We still have two matters on the agenda before we adjourn. So we have a forthcoming resolution. This is a resolution that Legislator Lopez is going to be submitting, resolution number 97, supporting the reintroduction of the National Plan to End Parkinson's Act and proclaiming April 2023 as Parkinson's Awareness Month in Ulster County. So, Legislator Lopez, if you want to give any background, I think this is really awesome.
Sure, yeah. No, it's exactly what the title says. So it's a reintroduction. It was originally introduced, I think, in 2001, but it wasn't voted on prior to the adjournment of the 117th Congress. So now we need sponsors again. So I've reached out personally to Congressman Molinaro, who is willing to be a sponsor, and he was going to reach out to Congressman Ryan as well, and see if he will be a co-sponsor, so they have a bipartisan sponsor in order to move forward. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. It creates an advisory board of federal agencies and non-government experts, and they kind of they collaborate, to eventually come up with a cure for Parkinson's.
Thank you. Any questions or comments or discussion?
Are you looking for sponsors too?
Absolutely.
I'll add my name to this.
I would love to see the whole committee
sign
on as co-sponsors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think this whole committee, you can add the whole committee.
Is Tom nodding?
Oh, yeah. He gave an emphatic thumbs up. All right. So thank you so much, Legislator Lopez.
Thank you.
And then the last thing, since we already addressed the Resolution 200 of 2022, Resolution 461 of 2022, this was the one where I'm the author. I had made a request for an appropriation from funds in excess of the fund balance threshold. There was two components to it. One component was adjusting the fund balance policy to make it a compulsory allocation over to a housing fund whenever we had a balance in excess of the threshold. And then the second part was making an initial allocation. The amount in the amended form was $20 million. I wanted it on the agenda for this momentous moment where I am going to share with you all that I am withdrawing this because I am so excited about County Executive Metzger's state of the county that included the $15 million allocation. So I'm withdrawing this one, and I intend to resubmit something that is in lockstep with the county executive so that we can achieve this goal, and I'm so excited about it. All right, and with that, if there's no other discussion, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All right, moved by Nolan, second by Erner. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Brian.